Another week of Truth Jihad Radio, right here at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, trying to bring you the most outside-the-box, important thinking on a whole variety of subjects. Sometimes I wander pretty far outside the box, and right now I am about to wander outside the box of political correctness. That's right. It's one thing to say that your government blew up the Twin Towers and killed 3,000 people. It's another thing to say that, well, who knows, maybe there's some secret military program spraying toxic chemicals into the air. I've brought up all kinds of these subjects, and you know, it all grows out of my having looked into 9/11, which convinced me that history isn't always what they tell us it is. Once you've looked into a question like that, in which the empirical evidence is so overwhelming that this was a false flag operation, not an attack by a bunch of Arab jihadis, then you have to ask yourself, well, what else would we be wrong about? What else could the professors be wrong about? And of all of the many topics that the conventional wisdom might be wrong about, maybe the most taboo of all is the official version of the Nazi Holocaust. This is one that it's an issue that gets people so angry, so excited, that most folks, even folks who bring up 9/11 truth, who will talk about what really happened with the JFK assassination, will even dabble in questions of UFOs and chemtrails and things like that, just don't want to go there. You know, I never really doubted the more or less official version of this story, although I didn't completely believe it either, because I just don't believe anything until I've looked into it myself. And somewhere into my first year or two as a 9/11 truth researcher, I suddenly was being attacked by people that I hardly knew, claiming that I was somehow sympathetic to Holocaust deniers. And these were Holocaust deniers that I'd never even heard of. Well, two out of the three that I was accused of being sympathetic to, I'd never even heard of. This bizarre slander, which then sort of followed me around, and then I noticed that there were a few other people who were getting attacked in a similar way, really got me curious. What is it about this Holocaust denial issue that gets people so riled up, and why are there these slanderers running around pinning this label on people who have absolutely nothing to do with it, people like me? So I decided to learn something about the topic, and I went out and I read a couple of books about why they deny. I read books by Michael Shermer and I think Graubman is the co-author, called Denying History. That was the first one, and that makes a case that the Holocaust revisionists are not only wrong, but somewhat dubious personally. A lot of ad hominem stuff in there. And the factual stuff is interesting and, you know, somewhat convincing, but not entirely. Then I read Deborah Lipstadt's book. I believe that's just called Denying the Holocaust, as I recall. And that was not very impressive at all. That was basically three quarters nothing but just shrill ad hominems. Finally, I picked up a book that actually leans towards saying that the Holocaust revisionists have a case. The author is Thomas Dalton. The book is called Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides. We're going to bring on Thomas Dalton for the first hour of tonight's show, and then we're going to bring on Roberto Muhlenkamp and Andrew Mathis to refute him, or rebut him, in the second hour. So it should be a very interesting and taboo-shredding hour right here on Truth Jihad Radio.
Mm-hmm. Most people would never consider one brand of motor oil making much more difference than another until they try AMSOIL. AMSOIL is the first in synthetics. AMSOIL's top-selling dealer wants to offer you American-made value to support this radio network. Check out SyntheticWarehouse.com and understand how AMSOIL saves you time, money, and increases performance in old and new cars. Give us a call at 800-579-0580 to find out how AMSOIL saves money in your daily commuter, truck, or other equipment. Enjoy the added performance. Support this network and add AMSOIL to your life. Call us at 1-800-579-0580 or check out the site. That's SyntheticWarehouse.com. Last year, overall lubricant industry sales dropped 11%, while AMSOIL sales have increased 14%. That's because our products work as advertised. Change your oil once a year and support American Freedom Radio. Go to SyntheticWarehouse.com today.
We all need to prepare ourselves. You might have the food, water, gold, and silver, but ask yourself, are you truly prepared? That's why you need to visit MaineMilitary.com. MaineMilitary.com carries everything you need. Gas masks, wool blankets, fire starter kits, high-capacity magazines, chemical suits, military surplus items, and much more. Do you own a firearm? MaineMilitary.com has a large selection of pistols and rifles suited for your needs. Are your local stores sold out of ammunition? Call or visit them today for prices on hard-to-find ammo and bulk ammo orders. You don't need to worry about having a military surplus store in your area because MaineMilitary.com is the only store you'll ever need, all from the comfort of your computer. Visit them online today at MaineMilitary.com. That's Maine, like the state, military.com. Or call them at 1-877-608-0179. That's 1-877-608-0179.
Attention, an important product from HempUSA.org, microplant powder, will change your life by removing all types of positive toxins, such as heavy metals, parasites, bacteria, viruses, and fungus from the digestive tract and stomach wall so you can absorb nutrients. Microplant powder is 89% silica and packed with a negative charge that attracts positive toxins from the blood, organs, spine, and brain. This product has the ability to rebuild cartilage and bone, which allows synovial fluid to return to the joints. Silica is a precursor to calcium, meaning the body turns silica into calcium and is great for the heart. There is no better time than now to have microplant powder on your shelf or in your storage shelter. And with an unlimited shelf life, you can store it anywhere. Call 908-691-2608 or visit hempusa.org. It's a great way to change your life. So call 908-691-2608 or visit us at hempusa.org today.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Can you handle the truth? Tune into the Truth Brigade with Christy Chakowski weeknights from 7 to 9 p.m. Central, only on American Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. This is Truth Jihad Radio, and we are going where few talk radio shows dare to go with a two-hour back and forth on the question of Nazi Holocaust revisionism. We're starting with Thomas Dalton, Ph.D., the pseudonym of a humanities professor who, for obvious reasons, doesn't want to give out his real name and university affiliation. His book is called Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides. And it is actually a pretty balanced, thoughtful, fact-oriented book. It's not full of any kind of bigotry or ad hominems or anything like that, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily right. So let's bring him on up and find out a little bit about this book. So, hey, welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, Thomas Dalton. How are you, Thomas?
I'm fine, Kevin. Can you hear me okay?
You're coming through loud and clear.
Great, thanks.
So, yeah, it's good to have you on. This is the first time I've really devoted a show to this topic. And let's start out with just clarifying our terms. What is the Holocaust in this context, and why is it so important?
Well, right, we have to have a good understanding of, I guess, what we would consider the basic elements of this event called the Holocaust, because we use the term quite frequently, and I think people don't really understand what it consists of. But at least from the conventional side, there's at least three main elements that are parts of this Holocaust story. I guess the first one, the one that most people know about, are the gas chambers themselves, which are key to the whole story. In fact, on the standard view, about 3 million of the 6 million Jewish deaths were due to gas chambers. So we have to have the gas chambers. That's one piece. The second piece is the intentionality, meaning it was a deliberate and systematic plan to murder the Jews of Europe. And then the third piece, of course, is the number 6 million itself, which is a kind of a touchstone for the whole story. And we hear this number repeated in the media, in journals, and Wikipedias, and in our schools, and so forth.
Well, Thomas, let me stop you there, because that's pretty much the same definition of the Holocaust that was given by Michael Shermer and, I think, is it Alex Grobman in their book Denying History. And they claim that anybody who says who has any disputes about the 6 million, the intentionality, and the gas chambers is a Holocaust denier. But that wouldn't that make Raoul Hilberg, the leading Orthodox scholar of the Holocaust, a denier?
Well, that's a good point, because they use this term Holocaust denier, but never really define it, because it's a very vague and arbitrary sort of term. Technically, if you challenge any one of those three main pillars of the account, then apparently you're some kind of a denier. At least that's what they would have you think. So that's true. Raoul Hilberg, who was for about 40 years, he was the leading scholar on the Holocaust, and for that same 40 years, he claimed that there were only 5 million Jews killed by the Nazis. So, yeah, I guess by their own definition, we would have to count Mr. Hilberg as a denier.
And that's pretty strange. There are a number of things about this issue that still puzzle me. And frankly, after reading your book, I haven't had them all cleared up. But let's move on to the question of why do you think that the so-called revisionists have a case? You've said that the people who are questioning these three elements are quote unquote revisionists. And the Orthodox scholars are the traditionalists. And your book tries to look at the arguments from both sides, and it comes down on saying, you know, at the end of the day, you argue that these revisionists actually have a case that needs to be considered by thoughtful scholars and others. Why is that?
Well, there's about seven major points, major weaknesses in the standard story, which are really not addressed very well and threaten to really undermine that standard account that we hear so much about. The first point is the witnesses, and the witnesses are really key to the whole standard story of the Holocaust, because there's really nothing else to go on. There's very little evidence. There are no remains of the bodies. We don't really understand the alleged murder process very well, so we are really relying on the witnesses, but we have problems with them, because many of the key witnesses have either falsified or significantly exaggerated important parts of their story. It doesn't mean that they're outright liars, but it means there are significant problems with virtually all the major witnesses. The second point is the 6 million itself. And as we'll talk about that a little bit later, there's really no basis in fact for that 6 million figure in itself. Significant problems there. We can talk about that later. Thirdly, we have the death camps, major death camps, including camps like Belzec, Sobibor, Kalmno, and Treblinka, have basically vanished without a trace. They're completely gone. The evidence of them is gone. The remains of the alleged victims is gone. It seems utterly impossible that they would completely vanish. Fourth is the guessing techniques that were allegedly used. They Plan B and carbon monoxide to gas the Jews. But both of those methods have very serious problems, and the revisionists would claim they're basically ridiculous to attempt mass murder with those kind of gases. Fifth problem is the Hitler order. There's no evidence whatsoever that Hitler intended or ordered the death of all the Jews. There's simply no evidence. There's no secondary evidence. Hilberg himself said there was no budget for the Holocaust, there was no plan, and yet somehow we have this perfect scheme of mass murder that killed 6 million people and erased all trace of evidence. It seems impossible. Two other problems, the wartime air photos. We have photos, particularly from 1944, that show the camps at the height of some of the mass killings, and the photos themselves are strikingly calm. There's very little evidence of any kind of killing, virtually no evidence of mass murder in those air photos. And I guess the last major problem is the survivors, and we hear so much about the survivors and the restitution for them and so forth. In fact, there are so many survivors today that it seems like very few people actually died in the event.
Well, that's quite a long list. And unfortunately, since we only have about an hour, actual 45 minutes plus commercials and introductions and so on, we're never going to get to the bottom of all of this. Let's try to zoom in on some key issues here. Clearly, there was some kind of horrific ethnic cleansing visited upon Jews and others. And let's talk about that and others, because I don't think your book really does justice to that. The standard Holocaust account claims that not only were somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 million Jews killed, but also a large number of other people, including, you know, gypsies, homosexuals, communists, handicapped people, and on and on and on. And typically the number given would be well over 10 million for the total, perhaps 11 million being an average total. So how does this, when you're talking about the 6 million figure of Jews being exaggerated, how about the 11 million figure for everybody?
That's a valid point, and I think the problem is we lack so little evidence for even the 6 million, we lack less evidence for the remaining alleged 5. As far as I can tell, that seems to be a purely constructed number. We have no real evidence that I'm aware of that there were 5 million other victims. I don't know where they died, how they died, where the remains are, or what the evidence might be. So I consider that largely a fabricated figure myself.
Wow. Yeah, it's certainly puzzling when, you know, that was one of the things that puzzled me about your book, in where you're pointing at various issues that raise questions about the mass murder of millions of people. You were only looking at that 6 million figure for Jews. What are the key problems with that 6 million figure?
Breakdown,
you're talking about by time and place, by year and by camp, etc.
Well, I'm talking about the major categories. So, for example, Hilberg made an important contribution because he said the Jewish deaths fall into three major categories. First one is the ghettos, where so many Jews were confined for a number of years. Secondly is in the area of the shootings. There were significant shootings, particularly by the Einsatzgruppe in the eastern territories, in the captured Russian territory. And the third category is the camps, which would include the six exterminations.
That's very, very interesting. As far as that, of all of the arguments made for that 6 million figure, the one that they often seems to come back is the demographic issue. And I know in the Shermer and Grauman book, I believe they laid out a demographic argument for 6 million missing Jews. And you've addressed that question in your book. How does your analysis differ from theirs?
Well, right. If you look at the recorded figures for the Jewish world population, which is probably the only way you can really do it, because people were moving around so much during right before the war and during the war, it's very hard to track population figures by individual countries. So you really need to work on estimates of the world population. And the number right after the war, which is commonly agreed to, was just about 12 million. This was just at the end of the war. So, of course, if there were 6 million killed, we would have expected the world population just prior to the war to be 18 million. In fact, that seems to be impossible. We look at earlier numbers for world population of the Jews, particularly in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and the numbers are only in the 8 to 9 million range for the global population.
Now how sure are those numbers? Because I know that you plotted those as if they were absolutely certain. Then you moved on through 20th century numbers, and what you found was basically two sets. One set that matches late 19th century numbers, and then another set that was higher and that would actually more or less get closer to the standard version of the Holocaust and the 6 million killed version.
Well, that's true, because we really have very little confidence that we know much about where these numbers came from prior to the war. They were all self-reported numbers by Jewish agencies, basically. So we have not much confidence. This is a problem. They claim extremely high growth rates. If you look at the claimed growth rate in the population, say from 1880 up until before the war, it shows an extremely high growth rate. It's 1.5 or 2% per year, which is extraordinarily high, far higher than the growth rate of the Jewish population since the war, which was about 0.3%. So even by their own numbers, they seem to have an impossibly high growth rate to get to a high enough number that would allow for 6 million lost during the war.
And that growth rate then would be based on accepting the late 19th century, beginning of the 20th century figures that you've given. Are those figures universally accepted then?
Well, I think that's all we've got. I don't know how widely accepted they are. I know that they cause problems for the standard story, so you really see very little information on these global population numbers. You have to do a fair amount of digging even to find these numbers in the first place. So you have to go back to original sources from the New York Times in the late 1800s and forth, even to find documentation for these numbers. So I think probably the Jewish groups are not very confident in those numbers or in that growth rate, but they have a choice, because if they have to hold on to a 6 million loss, and to get down to 12 million after the war, then they had to have an impossibly high growth rate.
Well, that's interesting. I think that on that particular issue, after reading your book and Shermer's, I'm not sure that it's not convincing me either way. One issue that you raised, though, that is very interesting and kind of tantalizing is the question of the recurrence of the figure of 6 million Jews threatened by catastrophe. Tell us the history of that figure.
Well, really, that's a very striking fact, again, that very few people know, that when we look back in time, we see really an amazingly long history of this figure of 6 million Jews who are either suffering or starving or face some kind of deprivation. Even immediately after the war, if we want to ask at what point would it have been reasonably possible to know about the 6 million figure, then obviously you wouldn't know it if the war was over. But in fact, we know, for example, that the New York Times was publishing in immediately after the war, in May 1945, they published a figure of 6 million as a calculation for the total Jewish fatalities. So this was immediately afterwards. We have earlier references in 1944. We have a couple of statements showing claiming that 6 million Jews were wiped out. In 1943, we have statements that 2 million were killed and 4 million 1942, saying that 2 million have been killed, and this is a third of all the Jews who will be killed by Hitler. We have statements from the New York Times in 1940 saying 6 million Jews are doomed to destruction. We go back even before into the late 1930s. We find in the New York Times 6 million Jews dying of starvation. 6 million Jews were victims of government anti-Semitism into the mid-1930s. 6 million Jews facing expulsion and poverty. The first reference to 6 million Jews with reference to Hitler I found was in 1933. There's an article in the New York Times referencing 6 million Jews threatened by Hitler in 1933, just after Hitler came to power. And even going well back in time, you can go back to World War One. There are half a dozen references during World War One of 6 million Jews who were suffering in Europe. And even before that, we can go to the early 1900s and we find another half dozen references to the Jews in Russia, which has had nothing to do with, obviously, World War II, but this is during the Russian Revolution. We see stories counting 6 million Jews suffering in Russia.
Wow. And the earliest figure of 6 million Jews threatened figure you found, I think, was back around 1870, as I recall. We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Thomas Dalton. His book, Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides, is getting a lot of interest in the circles of people who question history. We'll be back in a moment.
Get free of harmful chemicals in your lawn, garden, or farm. Use the products proven to work and restore vigor to your important food crops. Increase hay yields, as well as oils in seeds and grain. Check out AgGrand Natural Organic Fertilizers on our website, liquidorganicfertilizer.com. Learn how AgGrand's liquid organic fertilizers reduce costs while increasing yields. The products work great as a foliar feed and help offset problems caused by poor soil conditions. Call us at 1-800-579-0580 for more info. Converting to organic is fun and easy and is the best choice for your heirloom seeds. Take advantage of our liquid lime, sulfate of potash with kelp, liquid bone meal, and the menhaden fish 433 loaded with micronutrients. If you want better tomatoes, visit liquidorganicfertilizer.com. That is liquidorganicfertilizer.com for your garden, lawn, and farm.
My name's Don Wiskin. For over 10 years, I've been telling people about Cartavite. Here's Dr. John Mattson, a naturopathic doctor's views on Cartavite.
In our mind, there isn't such a great big mystery to disease anymore. This basic tenet of yeast in the gut and metals in the liver covers at least 70-80% of the diseases that we see. When we do our program, you know, herbal formulas like Cartavite, and you see someone who could barely walk up a hill now going for regular jogs a few months later, we know we're doing something right. It's a well-thought-out formula. I mean, the idea of it working on yeast and metals both at the same time and liver function is dead on. You'll find, I think, that it'll work more than just on heart problems and circulation problems. It'll work on other problems as well.
To learn more, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit our website at www.heartdrop.com or call 1-877-928-8822. Cartavite is available in either capsules or tincture.
Looking to save time, money, and fuel in your car while increasing performance? Switch to AMSOIL. AMSOIL's top-selling dealer wants to offer you American-made value to support this radio network. Check out SyntheticWarehouse.com for the latest in AMSOIL synthetic lubricants and filters. AMSOIL makes driving fun again. Trust the first 100% synthetic motor oil licensed in North America. Since 1972, it remains the only oil backed with a guarantee. Buy your automotive products from SyntheticWarehouse.com today. For motorcycles, AMSOIL is also proven to be the number one top performing oil available. Cut temperatures, enjoy smooth shifting, longer clutch life, and increase horsepower. 25,000-mile oil change intervals are standard for gas and diesel. Call 800-579-0580. But check out the site at SyntheticWarehouse.com. Double the life of your transmission. Go to SyntheticWarehouse.com today.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
Practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
News and information the mainstream won't touch. An American Warning Radio. right here, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 p.m. Central.
You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio, right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the home of real free speech and radio. No topics are taboo here at American Freedom Radio. And we're taking on one of the hottest topics, or one of the most dangerous third rail topics out there, the question of the Holocaust revisionists versus the standard academic consensus. My guest this hour is Thomas Dalton, author of Debating the Holocaust. We will be bringing on a couple of folks with very different views in the second hour, so don't worry. You will be getting another view of this question. Thomas, clearly there have been a lot of Holocausts and genocides throughout history, taken in the broad sense of those terms. Tens of millions of Native Americans, maybe as many as 100 million plus, killed by disease, extermination of various kinds. Africans in the slave trade, well into the double figures, 10 million perhaps. There are some Africans claiming 100 million. And we could go on and on about these kinds of cases. But in these cases, of course, you'll have some Afrocentric historians claiming 100 million African deaths in the slave trade, and other historians saying it was not even 10 million, and nobody seems to be drummed out of polite society. But with this particular question of the Nazi Holocaust, especially the Jewish side of the Nazi Holocaust, anybody who drops below 6 million to, you know, let's say 5,999,999 is immediately vilified. It's very strange. Why is this particular Holocaust exceptional in this sense?
Well, you have a very strong vested interest that support this standard story, right? They need to have a very large number of victims, and I'm talking here the Israel lobby or the Jewish lobby, which is very strong in this country. There's a very strong grip on the media institutions in the U.S., very great influence in government, in Congress. AIPAC is the second or third most powerful lobby in Washington. And, of course, we know there's this issue of foreign aid. Israel gets something like $6 billion every year from the United States government. And part of this is sort of based on a generic kind of sympathy towards Israel and the Jews that suffered in World War II. And, of course, there's the ongoing struggle in the Middle East and in Palestine. Again, it's an issue of sympathy and perhaps even guilt that Israel likes to use against the Western countries. They like to bring up the Holocaust and the 6 million deaths to deflect criticism from Israel's policies. So this has a very large consequence throughout the world. It's a factor in the war on terror and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and possibly future wars with Iran. These all stem in large part from this possibly defective Holocaust story.
Well, theoretically, the Holocaust story should not justify Zionism, because it obviously wasn't the Palestinians that did the Holocaust. No matter how many crazed Zionists have tried to blame the Mufti of Jerusalem for the Holocaust, that just doesn't wash. So it's completely irrational. But I think you're right that even at this mythological, irrational level, the story of massive Jewish suffering in the Nazi Holocaust has been used to irrationally, and I would add, in an evil way, justify the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, or let's call it the Palestinian Holocaust, the Nakba, which is coming up, Nakba Day is coming up next month. Still, the question of details, such as body count, you know, body counts are always going political hot potatoes going back and forth. Some would argue that body counts are always going to be exaggerated for political purposes. But this particular body count seems to be so important. And people like you who take seriously those who offer much smaller body counts get so much criticism. But let's talk about a couple of the hard questions for the revisionists. The revisionists claim that the death camps, the six camps that were death camps, there were only six death camps according to the Orthodox historians now. There's Auschwitz, the most famous and biggest one, and then there are five others. And the revisionists say that these were actually transit camps. The Jews were being ethnic cleansed and shipped to the Eastern Front, chased into Russia in the middle of this war. If this is true, number one, what are we to make of supposed records showing these millions of people being sent to these alleged death camps without any records of them being going out? And then secondly, if they did somehow go out and got shipped to the Eastern Front, why aren't there more stories of these people? If millions of people got sent out of these supposed death camps to the Eastern Front, why is there so little evidence that this happened?
Well, it's true that this is a sort of one aspect, I think, that is lacking in the revisionist account, and I think they acknowledge that themselves, that it's not entirely clear where all the people ended up. They make general claims that, well, they're still basically alive somewhere. They just got scattered far and wide through the vast territories of the East, of Russia and its satellite countries there. But the documentation, the figures of people who were transported through these transit camps, which would include Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka primarily, you know, they have a fairly good story that says that these were camps that were on the route heading to the East. They were basically disinfection camps where they had to stop and treat the Jews and their clothing and their personal items for lice, which was spreading typhus, which was a very serious problem. So these camps, in fact, all the camps did in fact have gas chambers, which were treating these refugees who were on their way out of the Reich. And there's no doubt that Hitler and Goebbels and Himmler wanted to get them out. So no one really disputes the fact that they did round up and ship out several hundred thousand, possibly a few million Jews. But they did have to be treated, and the Germans were rigorous in treating them for this problem of typhus. So this is where the stories of the gas chambers come from. They were actual gas chambers that were used, on the revisionist view, to treat the budding typhus epidemic.
And it is interesting that the stories were kind of mixed up between the diesel exhaust and Zyklon B, Zyklon B being cyanide gas, and Zyklon B apparently was used for this disinfectant purpose. And the Orthodox historians actually admit this, that all of these camps did have Zyklon B disinfectant chambers. And I guess the current Orthodox view is that most of these so-called six death camps actually used diesel exhaust rather than Zyklon B cyanide gas. What are some of the issues with this diesel exhaust gas chamber model?
Well, again, that's a very good point, and it's one that very few people really know about. Of all the gassing deaths, there's about 3 million Jews of the six that were alleged to be gassed. Of those 3 million, 2 million were killed by carbon monoxide, and only 1 million by the famous Zyklon B. So it's really important to understand the problems with the carbon monoxide gassing. On the standard story, the carbon monoxide came from deep engines that were connected to the chambers. In fact, most major accounts of these camps will talk about the diesel engines that supplied the gas. But the problem is, whoever came up with that story did not realize that diesel engines put out very little, extremely little, carbon monoxide gas. Certainly not enough to kill human beings in any reasonable amount of time. And in fact, any person who knew anything about engines would never use a diesel engine to produce carbon monoxide for killing people. It's completely ridiculous.
So how about the counter-argument that the witnesses who thought they were diesel engines were just mistaken about what kind of engine it was, and they were actually gasoline engines?
Well, right, this is probably what your guests will say in the second hour. They think that they were gasoline engines. Just for comparison, a diesel engine puts about one-tenth of 1% of carbon monoxide gas. A gasoline engine puts out about 5% carbon monoxide, which is certainly enough to kill someone in 15 or 20 minutes. So they can claim, well, it was just a gasoline engine. There's two problems. First of all, they really have no good witnesses to really say that it was a gasoline engine. Probably the best one, the most famous one, is Rudolf Rader, who was a survivor from Belzec, and he said that they were gassing Jews with gasoline engine, but he explicitly said the exhaust gas from this gasoline engine was vented away to the open air. So one of the best witnesses for a gasoline engine said that the exhaust was sent away rather than into the chamber, which literally makes no sense. But probably the bigger problem is that when you poison someone with carbon monoxide gas, there's a very characteristic result, which is that the skin turns very, very red, bright red or pink. It's a very noticeable characteristic on a large percentage of people who are poisoned with carbon monoxide. And of the many witnesses to the alleged carbon monoxide gas chambers, we see instead repeated references to blue corpses. And this is physiologically impossible if they are in fact were carbon monoxide poisoned. And in fact, we have no witnesses that reference red or pink coloration on the skin of the victims. So this argues against the diesel engine, the gasoline engine, any kind of carbon monoxide. You would never get a blue victim.
Hello, Thomas.
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, hi. Sorry, I just got disconnected. Little technical issue here. So
okay.
I haven't heard what you've been saying for the past couple of minutes.
Okay, so we were talking about the carbon monoxide, right?
Right.
Yeah, well, just to quickly summarize, again, the traditional story is a diesel engine, and the counterclaim is, well, it's a gasoline engine because it puts out more carbon monoxide, which is true, about 5% carbon monoxide versus a tenth of a percent. But I said we really have no good witnesses for the gasoline engine. This is the first problem. The second problem is that people who die from carbon monoxide poisoning turn a characteristic color, which is a bright red or pink. This is a discoloration on the skin. And in fact, we have no witness accounts of red or pink corpses coming out of these carbon monoxide gas chambers. In fact, just the opposite. We have a number of witnesses claiming that the bodies were blue. This is physiologically impossible if, in fact, they were carbon monoxide poisoned. So, really, this argues against any kind of carbon monoxide, gasoline, diesel, or anything else.
And once again, we get this issue of confused witness testimony, and this seems to be cropping up at all levels of this story. But isn't it true, though, Thomas, that sometimes in eyewitness situations, you're going to have a lot of eyewitnesses to some event, and a lot of them will get something wrong. But if you sort of try to find the commonalities, you can still get a picture of the event. And wouldn't that explain why, you know, maybe somebody thought it was diesel and it turned out it was gasoline, and somebody else, you know, that they didn't see the colors or notice the colors. In other words, how bad do the eyewitness accounts have to be before you start to really question the event that they add up to portraying? Well, we'll have to pick that one up after the break because we have hit the break. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Thomas Dalton, author of Debating the Holocaust. We'll be right back.
Of the 3 million plus edible food plants that grow on Earth, no other single plant can compare with the nutritional value of the powder, seeds, and oil of the hemp plant. At hempusa.org, we ship worldwide these nutritional products with free shipping to the U.S. and Canada. At hempusa.org, we want to educate our listeners that edible hemp is not marijuana and is certified THC-free. Our powder is 50% protein and does not contain gluten. Gluten impairs the cells from absorbing nutrients. This nutrient-dense food can be stored up to 5 years when vacuum-packed and is priced affordably to be used as a storable food. HempUSA.org is a bulk shipper starting with 5 pounds and up. To allow this food to work for you, call 908-691-2608 or go to HempUSA.org and order today. The body will react and heal itself given the proper nutrition. This superfood will be your greatest asset. So try it today, store it today, and change your life. Call 908-691-2608 or order from hempusa.org.
Now you and your family and friends can enjoy the cleanest, most delicious, and healthy drinking water anytime, even while traveling, camping, at sporting events, or in emergency situations. The Berkeleyte removes bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful chemicals to below detectable levels. It also reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury, while leaving in the beneficial and nutritional minerals your body needs. Percolite is so powerful, it can even purify raw, untreated water from remote lakes and streams. And the optional PF2 filters even remove fluoride. The Percolite LED, with its rechargeable lighting system, can be used as a nightlight or a camp light. To view or purchase your Perky water system and replacement filters, please visit American Freedom Radio's website at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click the Perky banner. Once again, that's AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click the Perky water banner. Not yet available in Iowa.
Hey, Jack Blood here, host of Deadline Live. I wanted to share with you my secret weapon in fighting the new world order. It's a new product called Enerfood. Enerfood is bar none the best health supplement I've tried, and I've tried them all. With many ingredients like spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, barley, grass, alfalfa leaf, beetroot, oil, winter cherry root, it really is nothing less than superfood. I couldn't imagine having to shop and prepare all of these ingredients, but now I don't have to. Enerfood's done it for me. A simple scoop of powder every day is all it takes. No fillers, no miracle claims, no magic bullets. Just a real product with real results. Call them today and mention Jack Blood and get a special discount. Get the two-pack special with the coconut oil powder. Call them now, 1-866-762-9238. 1-866-762-9238. Or simply go to enerfood.com. That's E-N-E-R, enerfood.com. Tell them Jack Blood sent you.
The time, your gateway to the world.
AFR
American Freedom Radio.
Give it to them.
This is Dave Von Kleist.
And Brent Johnson. For a daily dose of news and information, join us for the American Freedom Report.
Weekdays from 11 to 1 Central, right here on the American Freedom Radio Network.
Two, one, two, three, four.
Welcome back. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett. And if you're listening to this show from certain countries in the allegedly free world, shut down your computer right now, because this is illegal. The information that you are hearing, whether it's right or wrong, I don't know for sure, but you're just not allowed to hear this information. And in fact, if you were to, for instance, record tonight's show and send it as an MP3 file to somebody in, let's say, Germany, The Gestapo could kick down that person's door and arrest that person for a Holocaust denial if they sent it on to anyone else. You're not allowed to talk about this subject in many countries, or you could actually go to jail. That's one of the reasons I'm talking about it. I believe in absolute free speech, and I think it's just absurd that people are going to jail for their historical interpretations about an event from 60 years ago. That's why we're talking about it tonight. My guest is Thomas Dalton, author of Debating the Holocaust. Thomas, what's the story with Auschwitz, the biggest death camp, according to the conventional story? How many people did they gas there each day, and what are the objections against that from the revisionist side?
Right. Well, so Auschwitz, of course, is sort of the cornerstone of the whole Holocaust story. And we know, at least the current consensus, is about 1 million Jews were killed there. Most of them, 90% of them, were gassed on the traditional story. And this was over a period of at least 3 years, 1942, 43, and 44. The camp ran for almost three full years. So we have to somehow try to account for these 1 million alleged fatalities over this course of 3 years. And it's a very interesting exercise, which I do in the book, to try to construct how and when and how many people died in the course of those 3 years. You will not find this in any normal account of Auschwitz, because it makes the problems very apparent. But if we try to lay out the numbers such that they try to make sense, I make an effort to see if I can make them add up. I'm trying to accommodate the traditional story as much as possible. But you find out, for example, that really very few Jews were gassed for most of that time. In fact, there was one very small one. 1944, when 400,000 Jews from Hungary were allegedly gassed at Auschwitz. So this is obviously a large number. This is almost half of the entire Auschwitz death toll, which occurs in just 8 weeks in the summer of 1944. So this would be an impossible problem to account for. How could you gas and burn 400,000 people in just 8 weeks? It's really an astounding problem. This is one issue. The other issue is then the remaining 600,000 fatalities were spread out over almost 3 years, which it takes very simple elementary mathematics, and you can see that very few people were gassed, in any given day. The number turns out to be relatively small. I mean, in absolute terms, of course, it's a tragedy, but the numbers turn out to be something like 500 people per day. But if you believe the capacity, they had a huge gassing capacity. They had 5 crematoria. They had 2 bunkers, each of which was capable of gassing a couple thousand people at a time. But the numbers show that, in fact, Auschwitz gassed maybe in total 500 people per day on average. This is about 0.8% of this alleged capacity, which really makes no sense. The way the camp was designed with the gas chambers and the crematoria, it simply makes no sense that this is how the Germans chose to get rid of 1 million Jews.
So what would be the alternative account of what was going on?
Well, the alternative is that, first of all, the numbers were much smaller. There's no doubt that many Jews, many thousands of Jews, did die at Auschwitz. The revisionists promote numbers like, I believe they're mostly in the range of 100,000 to 150,000. They don't think any of them were gassed. They think the gas chambers were strictly for disinfection and treatment for the typhus lice. But people did die. People got typhus and died. They were shot. Some arrived dead in the trains. And you can pretty well account for maybe 100 or 150,000 deaths over those 3 years. But to account for 1 million deaths and disposing of the bodies and the lack of evidence for the ash and the burial pits for the ash, it is impossible to reconcile. And this is why you see no attempt to do so. They just brush over the details that would make the story comprehensible.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that bothers me about this is quotes like that Committee of French Intellectuals who said that we must not question how it was done because we know it was done. And, of course, that's the same argument we got from, was it Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather, about the JFK assassination and the magic bullet, was, we can't question whether it's possible for a bullet to do all these impossible things because we know it happened. And that's just not the right kind of logic to use in these cases. So finally, we only have a couple of minutes left. Did you want to raise any issues about the forensic evidence of bodies for all these victims?
Well, yes. I mean, we'd like to know where these bodies are. Supposedly, on the traditional story, certainly for the three camps, Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka, the traditional story says the Jews were gassed. They were buried on the campgrounds. Sometime later, they changed their minds, dug up the bodies, which were half-rotting, sometimes frozen because they were in the middle of the winter, and then burned them thousands per day on makeshift fires in the camps. And then they, once burning these bodies to pure ash, which would leave, of course, hard parts of the body like the bones and the teeth, so they would have to take all this ash, they would have to sift through it for bones and teeth, they would have to manually grind these to dust and bury them along with all the ash. It's a mass disposal problem. We have no evidence of anything like this at all.
Okay, we've covered a lot of the key points you've touched on in your book. It's on the web at debatingtheholocaust.com. Have you been able to get some people on either side of this issue to meet together to debate?
Well, I think we find reluctance to debate. I think the traditionalists know that they have very weak points, and they're really sort of uncomfortable with debating the issues, unfortunately.
Okay, well, we'll bring a couple of them on in the next hour, hear what they have to say, and maybe we can bring you guys back to get face-to-face at some point. There's enough interest. Well, thanks, Thomas Dalton. Appreciate your coming on. Your book is Debating the Holocaust, and good luck with your future research. Maybe we'll have you back on for a face-to-face debate sometime.
Hey there. This is Tom Ward with a question. What's in your water? Not sure? Many aren't. Still looking around heavy, expensive, and wasteful bottles just because you don't trust your tap water? Now you don't have to, thanks to Echolo Blue. The Echolo Blue 30 atmospheric water generator extracts moisture straight from the air or turns your tap water into 99.98% pure drinking perfection. Continuously, efficiently, and without plastic bottles. At an average cost of just 20 cents per gallon at 8 gallons per day, you'll save lots of money over bottled water and ensure the health and safety of you and your family. Get off the grid and declare your water independence today. Go to echoloblue.com today to get the ultimate in pure, cost-effective, and bottle-free drinking water. Or call 800-691-6043. That's ECOLOBLUE.com or 800-691-6043. Echoloblue, leading the water solution revolution.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to heextract.com.
We all need to prepare ourselves. You might have the food, water, gold, and silver, but ask yourself, are you truly prepared? That's why you need to visit MaineMilitary.com. MaineMilitary.com carries everything you need. Gas masks, wool blankets, fire starter kits, high-capacity magazines, chemical suits, military surplus items, and much more. Do you own a firearm? MaineMilitary.com has a large selection of pistols and rifles suited for your needs. Are your local stores sold out of ammunition? Call or visit them today for prices on hard-to-find ammo and bulk ammo orders. You don't need to worry about having a military surplus store in your area because MaineMilitary.com is the only store you'll ever need, all from the comfort of your computer. Visit them online today at MaineMilitary.com. That's Maine, like the state, military.com. Or call them at 1-877-608-0179. That's 1-877-608-0179.
Prepare your mind to experience American Freedom Radio.
I want it!
Rents Radio with Jeff Rents. Deadline Live with Jack Blood.
The Truth Brigade. Truth Jihad Radio.
Liberty Cafe.
Weird Radio Russell Dowden. And so much more.
American Freedom Radio.
Take a smile.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of tonight's special ultra-controversial edition of Truth Jihad Radio. And you know that if it's an ultra-controversial edition of Truth Jihad Radio, it's pretty controversial because we maintain a high level of controversiality every night. But we're going up to the stratosphere tonight, taking on the issue of Holocaust revisionism. In the first hour, we heard from Thomas Dalton, author of Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides. In this hour, we'll be bringing on two of the leading anti-revisionists from the blogosphere. I did try to bring on, or I invited, dozens and dozens of professors from Holocaust and Genocide Studies programs, but they're pretty happy with their current positions, and they don't need the trouble, I guess. So they all pretty much ignored me and in a couple of cases turned me down. But we fortunately have two of the very top names from the blogosphere, Roberto Muhlenkamp He's main guy at Hollis Controversies. And we're bringing on my old friend Andrew Mathis, who I've had on before, who did a really good job of addressing some issues brought up by I forget the name of the Christian that he wanted to bring on to who was attacking Judaism by way of the Talmud. And Andrew did a very good job of discussing that issue thoughtfully and factually. So let's hope he'll do that again tonight. So let's welcome our guests. First, Roberto Muhlenkamp. How are you, Roberto?
I'm fine, thanks. Ken, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to have you. And here, let's bring up Andrew. Andrew, is that you? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, is this Andrew?
Kevin.
Yes.
Kevin, are you there?
Great. Yes, I'm here.
I wasn't sure I was brought on.
It's great. This is Andrew, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Hey. Well. Welcome. It's good to have both of you on, and I'm sure that you probably both have a lot to say about what we heard from Thomas Dalton during the first hour. He's written this book, Debating the Holocaust, in which he tries to look at both sides. But hey, he comes down on the side of revisionists, at least one group of the people he calls scholarly revisionists, arguing that there's the evidence indicates that there may have been no plan, or at least that there's no grand, premeditated plan to exterminate the Jews of Europe, that the total number killed was probably closer to 500,000 than to 6 million, and that there probably were not any execution gas chambers. What's your take on those points?
Shall I go first?
Or go right ahead,
Robert. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, I go first. First of all, a small correction. I wouldn't call myself the main guy on the Holocaust controversies blogspot. I'm okay. As main guy as Sergei Romanov and as Nick Terry and as Jonathan Harrison. I mean, we're all a team, okay? Everybody of us writes there, is a contributor. We have also guest bloggers, so thanks for the honor, but I'm not the main guy, okay?
Okay, we'll have you anyway. I've seen your work there and noticed it's fairly prominent.
Second thing is you say that you're under the impression that Mr. Dalton wrote, a balanced account of both sides.
Well, yes, that's what he calls his book.
That's what he calls his book. That's what he claims. That's what he pretends. I don't think that is true. I think... And I reached this conviction from reading the first chapters of his book, and as I read more of it today, I've come as far as cross-reading up to page 120 so something. I mean, this impression only grew stronger. The impression is that Mr. Dalton is a revisionist himself, or one of these people who call themselves revisionists, because I would call them revisionists. Revisionists are something else.
Okay, well, we're going into a break. We'll be back to pick it up from there in just a moment. So stay tuned. This is Kevin Durrett with Andrew Mathis and Roberto Muhlenkamp.
Yeah,
we'll be right back.
Okay.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Hey there, this is Tom Ward with a question. What's in your water? Not sure? Many aren't. Still looking around heavy, expensive, and wasteful bottles just because you don't trust your tap water? Now you don't have, thanks to Echolo Blue. The Echolo Blue 30 atmospheric water generator extracts moisture straight from the air or turns your tap water into 99.98% pure drinking perfection. Continuously, efficiently, and without plastic bottles.
At an average cost of just 20 cents per gallon at 8 gallons per day, you'll save lots of money over bottled water and ensure the health and safety of you and your family. Get off the grid and declare your water independence today. Go to Ecoloblue.com today to get the ultimate in pure, cost-effective, and bottle-free drinking water. Or call 800-691-6043. That's ECOLOBLUE.com or 800-691-6043. Ecoloblue, leading the water solution revolution.
Most Americans know the significance of July 4th, 1776. However, few know the importance of September 17th, 1787, the day the Constitution was written and adopted by our founders. Unfortunately, over 200 years later, this sacred document is under attack, along with our beloved Republic. Throughout the span of history, brave men and women have rallied behind banners, which have served as symbols of liberty against the forces of tyranny. Today, we have the Constitution Pride flag to show our support for the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, freedom, liberty, and justice for we the people of the United States. Now available at www.1787flags.com. Get your very own Constitution Pride flag today and receive a free pocket Constitution with your order. www.1787flags.com, the official website of the Constitution Pride flag. That's www.1787flags.com.
No rules. No rules. No taboo topics. No taboo topics. No fear of doom. No fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Hi, James Burns here, inviting you to join me each and every Saturday night, 9 to 11 p.m. Central Standard Time, for Freedom Files, right here on American Freedom Radio.
I told you before.
Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, coming at you every Saturday evening with the most interesting, outrageous, controversial, and sometimes important information as I can find. I try to pack all those qualities into the same issues and guests. And tonight we're talking about the issue of so-called Holocaust revisionism. The first hour guest, Thomas Dalton, author of Debating the Holocaust, yes, I would agree with you, Roberto. As you said before the break, I would say that at this point he is a revisionist. The way he presents his book, though, is that he goes through a number of issues looking at what he says the best of the scholarly revisionists say versus what the traditionalists say. And he claims on most of these issues to find the revisionist arguments more convincing, although on a few of them he admits that the traditional view has a very strong case. But yeah, I think he comes down on the revisionist side. But I think before we call him names and discredit him that way, we need to show why he's wrong. So where are the areas?
I don't want to expand on this, because otherwise we don't get to the rest. And I wrote an article about this. I'm just sending you the link. And now I'll go to, his arguments. Okay?
Okay.
As far as I can remember, he has a problem with the demographics, he says. He says that the Jewish pre-war population, if I understood correctly, could not have been high enough to match a Jewish post-war population of about 12 million or something like that, with a loss of 6 million. Yes?
That's right.
He says that there are no reliable data, if I understood him correctly, about the Jewish pre-war population. I think this is simply not true. Okay? I think there are very good pre-war demographic data about the Jewish population in Europe and in the world, and they do not all come from Jewish sources. They are not all self-reported. Some of them come from German sources, from Nazi sources. One of these sources is a German statistics expert by the name of Richard Korher. He was Himmler's statistics expert, and he wrote a report for Himmler about, he called it the final solution of the Jewish question in Europe. It was sort of a progress report of what was going on, of how the final solution of the Jewish question in Europe, the elimination of Europe's Jews, was progressing. In this report, he made a tabulation, country by country, of the Jewish population, yeah, of the pre-war Jewish population. And he arrived at a total of about 10 million Jews in Europe out of 7 million Jews worldwide. And then he calculated that about, that this was written in early 1943, so the final solution was underway but not yet complete. He calculated that about 4 or 5 million, something like that. No, I don't have exact number, I think it was 4, had already disappeared. 4 or 5 million had already disappeared. If you want to read the report, I can give you another link, which is a report you should absolutely read. Also, because Mr. Dalton, if I, I didn't miss anything, he doesn't mention this report at all.
I don't believe he does.
He doesn't. I haven't seen it, and this is one of the major omissions in Dalton's book. He doesn't mention this report at all. He doesn't mention Nazi sources, which did a calculation of how many Jews they had to deal with. So it's not just, as I said, not just the Jews reporting themselves. Okay? Then after the war, when we talk about the 6 million figure that he says it has no basis, and it is suspiciously close to figures that were being reported before about Jews in need throughout Europe. Yes, actually there were two demographic studies. Yes, done shortly after the war. One was by the World Jewish Congress. The other was by an Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry, so not a Jewish entity. They both arrived at a population loss, a demographic loss. It was in the neighborhood of 6 million. It wasn't exactly 6 million. It was something like 5.7 something, 5.8 something, yes. And of course, I could understand that this was rounded up to 6 million to have a round figure, to have a nice, neat round figure. Yes, but it's not like the 6 million had come out of nowhere, or as Mr. Dalton writes in his book, had only been based on the statements of some Nazi official. This is simply not true.
May I add something?
Yes. Hello.
Yes, Kevin. May I add? Yeah. What I wanted to say was that I believe that the Anglo-American Commission of Inquiry is the source of the 6 million figure in most of the literature on the topic. I know that Gerard Reitlinger, who published the first study in English on the Holocaust 1955, uses the figures, and actually Reitlinger for his own in his own book actually. Estimates a figure of around 4.5 million, which means, by the way, that not only is it true that the American Commission is one of the original sources for the 6 million figure, but it also shows that in English language studies that the 6 million figure has not always been canonical, and that several people have estimated figures both below and above that number. As you point out, Kevin, Raoul Hilberg posited in 1962, I believe, of 5.1 million, Reitlinger a number even lower than that. I believe Wolfgang Benz has posited a figure of above 6 million studies done since then. So the idea that the 6 million figure can't be disputed, I think, is probably wrong.
Okay, and then how would you view these sources that Dalton shows where there were many references to these 6 million threatened, including during World War II, at times when there was no way that any such body count could have been known? Is it just a strange
coincidence? To be frank about it, I don't think that it's a coincidence so much as cherry picking. I think that you can go through the literature and find sources that mention 2 million, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million, 7, 8, 9, and 10 million if you want to. I think that people go through literature searches, look for the term 6 million, find it, and point to some huge conspiracy that they believe is indicated by the fact that the term 6 million has been repeated, whereas if you actually go through the literature and do more extensive searching, you'll find that several figures have put forward. Now, with regard to figures coming forward during the war, I actually wrote a blog on Roberto's and my blog about 2 or 3 years ago about Ben Hecht writing an article in the Reader's Digest that had to do with the casualty figures, and it was actually falsely stated in the piece that I was refuting that Ben Hecht had said that there were 6 million Jews that had been killed or that were going to be killed. He was actually referring to a lower number and making a making an estimate that was in the in that area, but not specifically stating 6 million. So that the final body count would be 6 million Jews. I think that it's a red herring to a very large extent. And I think that any responsible historian, I think that Reitlinger is certainly the case here, I think that Hilberg's more extensive volume work also tends to adhere to this principle, is that it's far more responsible to posit a range rather than some firm figure. I think that because of the nature of what happened over such a long period of time, roughly 4 years, that you ultimately have to rely only on a range rather than getting some magic number. I think that's completely unrealistic otherwise.
Well, that makes sense, and I did actually mention this to Dalton earlier in an email exchange to this long list of 6 million figures that he finds going back all the way to the 19th century. How does that compare with other numbers that may also have been mentioned for those kinds of occurrences? And maybe that's a research project waiting for somebody to pick it up. In terms of his other arguments, I think. As I understand it, I've just read the Schirmer and Grobman and Lipstadt. I didn't really get a heck of a lot from Lipstadt, but it seems that the standard account both goes with these demographics and relies quite a bit on witness testimony, both Nazis at Nuremberg and. Whereas the revisionist account seems to be very much focused on both finding inconsistencies in those witnesses or problems with them, such as the alleged torture and so on at Nuremberg, and then also looking at the logistical issues such as how were so many people killed, how were they disposed of, and so on. How do we make sense of these sort of two different perspectives?
I want to bounce this over to Roberto very quickly because he has far more experience of the testimony than I do, and plus, he reads German fluently. I do not, and he's been able to read much more of the testimony in the original languages. I think that, again, Nuremberg is a bit of a red herring. Most of the good testimony offered on the death camps was actually offered in the 1960s in Germany, in German courts, and I think that that's a key point. At Nuremberg, for instance, you have Rudolf Hirsch, the commandant of Auschwitz, testifying to a number that is impossible for Auschwitz, and the claim is often made that he was tortured into giving that number. He was a defense witness at Auschwitz. He wasn't tried there. He was appearing as a defense witness for Ernst Kaltenbrunner, who was the head of the Reich Security Head Office. And I found it difficult to bear out the idea that a defense witness was tortured. I leave that to them to explain. But I think that Roberto is going to be able to provide a lot of information about the trials in West Germany in the 1960s and the testimony there. So I'm going to go over to him for that.
Okay.
Yes, Kevin. Well, as Mr. Dalton says, I mean, he's not completely wrong in saying that the historical record is, to a large extent, based on eyewitness testimony. But that is true of any historical record. Yes? That is true of the historical record of the Soviet Gulag camps. That is true of the historical record of Red Army atrocities against the German population in 1945. That is true of any historical record of the historical record of slavery and so on and so forth. Of course, much of the account, much of what of received history is based on eyewitness testimony. But eyewitness testimony is not the whole story. Also, not as concerns the Holocaust. There's a lot of testimony. There's a lot of documentary evidence. There are lots of. I mean, the Germans, the Nazis, they tried to destroy much of their documents, and they succeeded in destroying, but through negligence, confusion, and whatever, much documentation survived, and much of this documentation is very explicit, and allows, above all, for reconstructing the overall picture, the intent, the policy. And death toll. I just mentioned this Korher report, a very important piece of documentary evidence, which Mr. Dalton doesn't mention at all. Yes, from this Korher report, and from a recently discovered intercept of a radio report, sent in 1943, we can reconstruct exactly how many Yeah, how many Jews were transported from the Polish general government to the camps of Belzec, Treblinka, Sobibor, and to Majdanek in 1942? The exact number, they match. Yes, so there's this very important documentary evidence, and it's also not like, as they say, it's also not like there were a dearth or a lack of physical evidence. This is not true. Yes, especially in the occupied Soviet territories, Soviet commissions, they did lots of exhumations because the Nazis, they did not always succeed in burning their victims. In many cases, the mass graves, they still contain the bodies. Yes, and where they didn't contain the bodies, they contained bone fragments, some and ashes and so on, always traces you could relate to human beings, even if you could not count them. Yeah, okay.
The question then arises is more, what kind of recent research has been done? Because I think where Dalton is saying that, you know, these revisionists would argue that they should still be there. They don't trust the post-war Soviet reports due to the incredible animosity between the Russians and the Germans at that time, and they point to examples where there were gross exaggerations. So what's the picture with more recent excavations and so on?
More recent research, what they do is, for instance, German historians, they take this approach. They compare. I mean, no historian, I think, takes a Soviet source at face value without comparing it with evidence that is independent of the Soviets. Okay? If you have a Soviet exhumation report that says they found so and so many bodies of people shot or gassed or something like that, then you look, is this matched by German documentation? Like these, for instance, there were the Einsatzgruppen. They send regular reports to the Reich Main Security Office, in which they tabulated the killings they had done. They gave the figures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, is there a record of a killing in one of these reports? If it is, then the Soviet exhumation data, they become more credible.
And are you saying that the Germans actually kept records of millions of killings?
They didn't keep records of, they kept some records. Well, in the occupied Soviet territories, when they in 1941, when the Germans invaded Russia, yeah, they sent these killing squads, which Mr. Dalton also mentions, the Einsatzgruppen, and they killed hundreds of thousands of Jews by shooting, mostly by shooting. I have noticed that Mr. Dalton doesn't say much about shooting. I don't know why. Yes, because shootings accounted for a great part of the victims, probably a greater number than Hilbert considers 1.3 million. Yes, these Einsatzgruppen for a while, at least in 1941 and until about February or April 1942, they sent reports to the Reich Main Security Office, and they said, in this place on this date we killed so and so many Jews, bandits, communists, and this and that. Yes, you can add up these reports.
I just want to add something here.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I just want to add that there's a French priest right now named Desbois that is actually going around Eastern Europe and examining these graves and finding that they're there. So the evidence is certainly evident that these shootings did occur. You have a copious eyewitness evidence regarding these mass shootings that happened in Soviet territory in 1941, 42, and to a much lesser extent in 43. And you have, on top of all that, besides the graves and besides the eyewitness testimony, you also have the reports, as Roberto was saying, that are going back to Germany at the time. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, in terms of that, these reports of the Germans of the shootings on the Eastern Front, is there a reason to believe that they would be carefully accurate, or is there the possibility that they would do what the Americans did in Vietnam and grossly exaggerate the body count of the so-called enemies that they were killing?
That has been the claim of revisionists, of course, that they did these kinds of things, but there is no indication that the Germans did not keep accurate records. How do we know this? We know this, for instance, because there were a number of files in West Germany Regarding these Einsatzgruppen killings, where the courts, one of the things they did was they compared the figures that became apparent from these Einsatzgruppen reports with other evidence, like eyewitness testimonies, like whatever Soviet exhumation data they had. And there is an astonishingly large match, I would say. Okay. So, I think we'll have to
pick this up after the break. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Barrett, speaking with Roberto Muhlenkamp and Andrew Mathis.
Hey, Jack Blood here, host of Deadline Live. I wanted to share with you my secret weapon in fighting the New World Order. It's a new product called Enerfood. Enerfood is bar none the best health supplement I've tried, and I've tried them all. With many ingredients like spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, barley grass, alfalfa leaf, beetroot, orange peel, winter cherry root, it really is nothing less than superfood. I couldn't imagine having to shop and prepare all of these ingredients, but now I don't have to. Enerfood's done it for me. A simple scoop of powder every day is all it takes. No fillers, no miracle claims, no magic bullets. Just a real product with real results. Call them today and mention Jack Blood to get a special discount. Get the two-pack special with the coconut oil powder. Call them now, 1-866-762-9238. 1-866-762-9238. Or simply go to enerfood.com. That's E-N-E-R, enerfood.com. Tell them Jack Blood sent you.
We all need to prepare ourselves. You might have the food, water, gold, and silver, but ask yourself, are you truly prepared? That's why you need to visit MaineMilitary.com. MaineMilitary.com carries everything you need. Gas masks, wool blankets, fire starter kits, high-capacity magazines, chemical suits, military surplus items, and much more. Do you own a firearm? MaineMilitary.com has a large selection of pistols and rifles suited for your needs. Are your local stores sold out of ammunition? Call or visit them today for prices on hard-to-find ammo and bulk ammo orders. You don't need to worry about having a military surplus store in your area because MaineMilitary.com is the only store you'll ever need, all from the comfort of your computer. Visit them online today at MaineMilitary.com. That's Maine, like the state, military.com. Or call them at 1-877-608-0179. That's 1-877-608-0179.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. No one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Warning. Warning.
American.
Warning.
American Freedom Radio
is habit forming.
American Freedom Radio
is habit forming.
Use the truth carefully.
News and information the mainstream won't touch. In American Warning Radio, right here, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 p.m. Central.
Okay, welcome back. This is Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, boldly going where no radio host has gone before. Well, maybe a few have, and bringing up the taboo and in many countries illegal subject of Holocaust revisionism. The first hour we had on Thomas Dalton, author of Baiting the Holocaust. Dalton ends up coming down on the side of the revisionists in his attempt to look at both sides, as he puts it. Right now I'm talking with Roberto Muhlenkamp, Andrew Mapp. They are both very active in combating what they see as falsifications of history by revisionists. And Roberto, actually, I just looked in Dalton's book, and he lists as his kind of standard orthodox view of Holocaust deaths 1.4 million by shooting. Is that close to the standard consensus?
That's more or less Hilberg, right?
Right.
And Hilberg is, I mean, there's recent research by German historians mainly. Hilberg is probably a little too low on the shootings. There were more shootings than Hilberg counted in the Soviet Union. Yes, and also during the evacuations of the ghettos in Poland and so on, lots of people died by shooting. For instance, in Galicia, eastern Galicia, a part of eastern Poland, much of the killing there was done by shooting. So Hilberg is probably on the low side, but I don't know. I didn't yet find. I mean, apart from this general figure that Mr. Dalton mentions, I don't think he addresses the issue at all. Unless there's something in the pages I haven't yet reached.
No, I don't think he makes any effort really to dispute that figure. I think what he questions is in part the numbers around the those who died in the ghettos, in part from privation, and primarily though those who died in the camps. He gives the standard sort of Hilberg derived figure of about 3 million for people who died in the camps, and then he goes into the forensic disputes about how they could have been killed and their bodies disposed of.
Okay, as concerned,
I think
sorry, Andrew, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, Robert. I think that the firing squad killings on the Eastern Front, they represent a very difficult problem for the so-called Holocaust revisionists for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, there's better documentation. Hitler, for one thing, was receiving reports about the killing squads on the Eastern Front, whereas he was not so much looking after what was going on in the camps. Second of all, so we have, for instance, we have better reporting, particularly because it's in the earlier stages of the war. Furthermore, we have, as I mentioned, a lot of eyewitness testimony. We have, among other things, that the revisionists are not really able to answer. We have the case of an SS man that's brought to trial in Germany during the war. His name is Max Teubner. And Teubner was a member of the SS. He had been brought up on charges because he had violated certain secrecy laws that the Third Reich had in place regarding people talking about or circulating photographs of what had happened on the Eastern Front with regard to these mass shootings. And Teubner was actually cited by an SS court for breaking these secrecy violations. And in his judgment, the judge that tried him actually made an explicit statement regarding the Third Reich's policy of exterminating the Jews on the Eastern Front. And it's a relatively damning piece of evidence regarding specifically what I think people like Dalton would try to say was that there was no real plan that was in place, that if there was killing, it was done on an ad hoc basis. And I think that that's something that can be debated at great length. But when you have somebody like Teubner coming up on trial, and you have a judge saying that the Jews are being exterminated as a matter of policy, then it becomes something that's a lot more difficult for them to refute. And they can make claims such as, you know, that they that the judge was in some way compromised, that the court paperwork isn't reliable, things like that. But nevertheless, we have it, and so it becomes something a lot more difficult for them to address.
Okay, well, yeah, let's move to that topic because that's one of the three pillars of revisionism, or the three bones of contention. That is the question of to what extent that this this vicious ethnic cleansing of European Jews by anybody's account, including the revisionists, was a premeditated attempt to eliminate all European Jews, or maybe all Jews, or not. And they claim that there isn't convincing documentation that this was an official policy. What's your response to that?
Well, there is convincing documentation. Yes. There is convincing documentation in the form of, let's say, references made by high-ranking Nazis, like Himmler, like Goebbels, two things Hitler had said and ordered. As for instance, there was a meeting with high-ranking party officials on the 12th of December, where Hitler said rather explicitly that he would go about solving the Jewish question, and that as there was a war going on because of the Jews, and as so many German soldiers had died, those who were responsible would have to pay for this with their lives. Goebbels recorded this in his diary. There is another entry. There is another entry in Himmler's agenda, where he wrote something about a conversation with Hitler, which reads, "Jews are to be exterminated as partisans." That means Jews are to be exterminated under the pretext that they are partisans, guerrilla fighters, or something like that. Mm-hmm. There is a very explicit statement by the Governor Frank on the 16th of December 1941 with Governor of the General Government Frank in Krakow. He also spoke very clearly that we will somehow find a way to eliminate these Jews, and he was talking about physical killing. There is no other interpretation possible. I have noticed, by the way, that in one of his articles, not in his book, Mr. Dalton quotes a part of this speech, but he doesn't quote the interesting part. I was a bit upset at that. There is the reference in the protocol of the Wannsee conference. Yeah, it was sort of a coordination meeting between high-ranking party officials as secretaries of state to coordinate the procedures after the decision had already been taken. And there they say something like, the able-bodied Jews, they will be taken to the east, and there most of them will die of natural causes, and the rest we will take care of. It's obvious that this means killing them. Yes, and it leaves open the question: what will happen to the Jews which are not able-bodied, which cannot work? Well, I think the only reasonable conclusion is that they were to be killed right away. Then there is a diary entry by Goebbels. Maybe you remember this, Kevin, because Dalton discusses this in his book, and he tries to give it another meaning than it has. But this attempt to reinterpret this diary entry.
Let's talk about this. This comes up in a lot of literature. I've encountered it in many places, including Dalton's book. It's Goebbels' diary, correct, in which he describes the word liquidation comes up.
Yes, right? Liquidation.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then what exactly can you quote that passage?
I can quote that passage. I can quote it in German. I can quote an English translation by Mr. Evans from the Irving Lippstadt lawsuit. He says, "The Jews are now being pushed out of the general government, beginning near Lublin, to the east. A pretty barbaric procedure is being applied here and is not to be described in any more detail, and not much is left of the Jews themselves. In general, one may conclude that 60% of them must be liquidated, while only 40% can be put to work. The former Gauleiter of Vienna, Globochnik, it doesn't say Globochnik, we know it was Globochnik, the head of Action Reinhardt, who is carrying out this action, is doing this pretty prudently and with a procedure that doesn't work too conspicuously. The Jews are being punished barbarically, to be sure, but they have fully deserved it. The prophecy that the Führer issued them on the way for the eventuality that they start a new world war is beginning to realize itself in the most terrible manner. One must not allow sentimentalities to rule these matters. If we did not defend ourselves against them, the Jews would annihilate us. It is a struggle for life and death between the Aryan race and the Jewish bacillus. No other government and no other regime could muster the strength for a general solution of the question. Here, too, the Führer is the persistent pioneer and spokesman of a radical solution which is demanded by the way things are and thus appears to be unavoidable. Thank God, during the war, we now have a whole series of possibilities which were barred to us in peacetime. We must exploit them. The ghettos which are becoming available in the general government are now being filled with the Jews who are being pushed out of the Reich, and after a certain time, the process is then to renew itself here. Jewry has nothing to laugh about. This is the whole diary entry that Goebbels wrote on the 27th of March in 1942. And I know that Mr. Dallin's argument is that liquidated. I mean, it's not his argument. He borrows it from Gamma Rudolph, if I remember correctly, is that this liquidated means something else. But I mean...
I don't think Dalton actually comes down hard on saying that it definitely does, but he certainly entertains that possibility. And in English, in this context, the word liquidate would almost certainly be understood to mean kill, where yes. the 40% able-bodied would be put to work. That would be the obvious interpretation.
Same in German, exactly the same.
I would have to agree that the revisionist claim that in this sense the word liquidate could mean something other than kill seems somewhat far-fetched. On the other hand, what Dalton does say about that quote and seems to assert himself rather than just citing somebody else is that it shows that they were not planning to kill all Jews because they were putting 40% to work.
That's a red herring, and I think that it's important to point this out. I think that there is a general belief in the population that gets exploited by the revisionists to some extent that the Nazis had the intent and therefore actually practiced the policy of killing every Jew that they laid their hands on, but that's simply not the case, and no credible historian claims that that was the case. Obviously, if that were the case, you would not have an installation at Auschwitz, that you wouldn't have several installations for that matter at Auschwitz that are dedicated to utilizing slave labor. Nor would you have a whole network of slave labor camps throughout Europe, but nevertheless were sending their populations ultimately to the death camps to be exterminated. So what has to be understood, I think, is that you have a policy in the Third Reich with a couple of exceptions where you actually do have a sort of a kill everybody as soon as you get their hands on them approach, which is limited, I think, to mainly 1942, 1944. Whereas otherwise you have a policy that pretty clearly states if you have able-bodied workers, put them to work. And that's available in the survivor literature, it's available from Nazi government documents, it's available from eyewitnesses in other places, it's available in all of the credible historians again.
These 40% which were to be put to work, they were to die too. And this becomes apparent from a document, for instance, like the Wannsee Conference Protocol. The idea was that those who are not able to work, they are killed right away. Those who are able to work, they are put to work until they drop. Yes? So many will die from the work. And those who are strong enough to survive, this is clearly stated in the Wannsee Conference Protocol, they will be, I quote, treated accordingly, according to the official translation. Yeah? And that is in order to prevent a resurgence of Jewry. There are even more clear statements by Himmler.
Wait a minute, though. Resurgence, Roberto, to prevent a resurgence, one normally wouldn't think that would mean exterminating every last Jew, but rather one would think that would perhaps refer to this Nazi idea that Jews in Germany and elsewhere had taken a vastly disproportionate share of power and powerful positions, and that's the kind of resurgence that they were trying to prevent.
Well, then what was the treated accordingly? I mean, the survivors of forced labor, I mean, the guys who were not able to work, they would be killed right away. Those who were able to work, they would be put to work until they died, and some would survive. The strongest, of course, the most resistant ones. Then what was this treated accordingly? What was it to be? Were they going to castrate them or what?
Disturbing question in any event.
it's really
any way to slice it.
Okay. There's another thing. This diary entry of Goebbels, just before I end, Goebbels was not a squeamish fellow. Yeah, Goebbels was a tough guy. He had no problems with writing about executions, about people being killed. Yes, that you find lots of that in his diary. But here, he was talking about something that he didn't want. He was referring to something that he'd rather not talk about. He said a pretty barbaric procedure is being applied here, and it is not to be described in any more detail. It's something that even he shrank from talking about. It's something that frightened even him. Yeah?
It does sound incriminating. I have to agree that that particular entry from Goebbels' diary is very incriminating and supports something in the general ballpark of the standard account of the Holocaust. And this is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio, talking to Roberto Muhlenkamp and Andrew Mathis. We'll be right back.
Most people would never consider one brand of motor oil making much more difference than another until they try AMSOIL. AMSOIL is the first in synthetics. AMSOIL's top-selling dealer wants to offer you American-made value to support this radio network. Check out SyntheticWarehouse.com and understand how AMSOIL saves you time, money, and increases performance in old and new cars. Give us a call at 800-579-0580 to find out how AMSOIL saves money in your daily commute, truck, or other equipment. Enjoy the added performance. Support this network and add AMSOIL to your life. Call us at 1-800-579-0580 or check out the site. That's SyntheticWarehouse.com. Last year, overall lubricant industry sales dropped 11%, while AMSOIL sales have increased 14%. That's because our products work as advertised. Change your oil once a year and support American Freedom Radio. Go to SyntheticWarehouse.com today.
My name's Don Wiskin. For over 10 years, I've been telling people about Cartavite. Here's Dr. John Mattson, a naturopathic doctor's views on Cartavite.
In our mind, there isn't such a great big mystery to disease anymore. This basic tenet of yeast in the gut and metals in the liver covers at least 70-80% of the diseases that we see. When we do our program, you know, herbal formulas like Cartavite, and to see someone who could barely walk up a hill now going for regular jogs, few months later, we know we're doing something right. It's a well thought out formula. I mean, the idea of it working on yeast and metals both at the same time and liver function is dead on. You'll find, I think, that it'll work more than just on heart problems and circulation problems. It'll work on other problems as well.
To learn more, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit our website at www.heartdrop.com or call 1-877-928-8822. Cartavite is available in either capsules or tincture.
Attention, an important product from hempusa.org, microplant powder, will change your life by removing all types of positive toxins, such as heavy metals, parasites, bacteria, viruses, and fungus from the digestive tract and stomach wall so you can absorb nutrients. Microplant powder is 89% silica and packed with a negative charge that attracts positive toxins from the blood, organs, spine, and brain. This product has the ability to rebuild cartilage and bone, which allows synovial fluid to return to the joints. Silica is a precursor to calcium, meaning the body turns silica into calcium and is great for the heart. There is no better time than now to have microplant powder on your shelf or in your storage shelter. And with an unlimited shelf life, you can store it anywhere. Call 908-691-2608 or visit hempusa.org. It's a great way to change your life. So call 908-691-2608 or visit us at hempusa.org today.
Yo, what's up? Check this out.
The voice of the revolution. American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Dark, funny, and mind-bending news. PSYOP Radio with Mac White and Smiles Lewis. Sundays at 7 to 9 p.m. Central. Only on American Freedom Radio.
Okay, we are back. This is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio. We're talking about Debating the Holocaust, a book by Thomas Dalton that comes down on the side of many revisionist conclusions about the Holocaust. This hour's guests, Roberto Muhlenkamp and Andrew Mathis, strongly disagree. Let me ask you guys, Roberto and Andrew, about the stuff that you've just been citing in terms of this the Holocaust being planned and intentional. It still makes you wonder whether it fit with this picture that was painted by Raul Hilberg in the quote that Dalton makes much of, puts on his jacket, quote, "What began in 1941 was a process of destruction, not planned in advance, not organized centrally by any agency. There was no blueprint, and there was no budget for destructive measures. These measures were taken step by step, one step at a time. Thus came about not so much a plan being carried out, but an incredible meeting of minds, a consensus, mind reading by a far-flung bureaucracy." To what extent could the quotes that you've just cited from Goebbels and elsewhere be describing a horrific thing that was still primarily ad hoc and not part of a preordained plan?
I would say that Hitler, he never gave something like saying an order, saying, "I want this done now like this and that." What Hitler did, he authorized his officials, his paladins, people like Heydrich and Himmler and Göring and so on, he authorized them to organize a program for ridding Europe of the Jews. And this program was organized as any state ordained program is organized. It had its administrative involvement, it had its planning, it also had budgets. There was maybe not one big overall budget, but there were smaller budgets, of course. I mean, there was a budget to be sure for the Aktion Reinhardt camps, for the Belzec, Sobibor and Treblinka. Yes, we know that because they kept a strict account of expenses, and they kept a strict account of earnings. Earnings were all these things they took away from the dead Jews, clothing and valuables and so on and so on. Yeah, and this account has survived the war, and we know that they made a very good business. The costs were much below what their earnings were. So to say that there was no budget and no plan and so on, you can say that there was no central overall master plan. Yes. Hitler said, he didn't say, "I want this done." Yes, he didn't give an order like this. He said, "Please feel free to go ahead." And how they went ahead, and with what organization, and with what timing, and so on, that he left more or less to guys like Himmler, like Heydrich, like Göring, also to guys on a lower level, on a lower organizational level. For instance, there was a Gauleiter in the Wartegau, in the area of Chemnitz extermination camp. He asked for permission to wipe out 100,000 Jews in his area. He got this permission. Yes, he got this permission, and he got it from Himmler. So Himmler had a certain autonomy to decide, yeah, when and who to when and how to kill a certain number of Jews, and he could pass on this authorization. So there was much greater independence and much greater freedom of the executors at a high level, but of course they were all acting with the blessing, so to say, of Adolf Hitler.
Yes. And this plan to rid Europe of the Jews, the argument, of course, from the revisionists would be that the basic plan was to push them out rather than to kill them. It appears, though, that, of course, many, many, many did die and many, many, many were killed. Yet, to what extent yes. Was that the original plan?
The original, there was.
Well, I think that it's important to bear in mind. That all responsible historians of the period, and you won't find a major study of the period written by any author in any country that doesn't take into account that policy by the Nazis shifted over the course of the war. So whereas the forced emigration policy was probably in effect certainly till the beginning of the war, and probably to a certain extent on the Western Front through the beginning of the Soviet Union, obviously because of the changing situation on the Eastern Front, that situation changed. It became impossible to deport Jews out of Europe entirely, and they weren't going to the Nazis were not going to reallocate food, for instance, much less other provisions that would be needed to keep people alive, when they had their own soldiers that they needed to feed on the Eastern Front, the Western Front for that matter as well, not to mention the German citizens back at home. You know, so if you don't take into account that there was a shifting policy during the war on the part of the Third Reich, then you're not taking into account the full picture.
Okay, well, let's move now. We only have a couple of minutes left. to the question of why is this debate so repressed? It seems to me that, you know, you guys have some pretty good arguments. I haven't studied this topic enough to be 100% certain who's exactly which issue is, you know, who's correct about which of these sub-issues. But why is this debate being repressed rather than exposed? Because if the evidence is so strong in favor of the consensus academic version, what in the world can possibly be the point of jailing people who express wrong views rather than refuting them?
The answer to this question, I think it varies from country to country. In the U.S., for instance, I think there is no law against. I mean, in the U.S., we can hold this conversation freely without anybody
Thomas
going
Dalton
to jail.
Thomas Dalton has to use an assumed name and a voice scrambler to come on the show. If he's genuinely a professor somewhere in the U.S., if he comes out and goes public with this, his life will be hell.
I don't know. There is a guy who is a known Holocaust denier. He posts under his own name. Everybody knows where he teaches. I don't know whatever happened to him.
A guy named Arthur Butz at Northwestern, and he's a national pariah. I would hate to be his kids.
Yes.
I would hate to be his family. The poor guy is, I think we need to demystify this whole subject and just have an honest debate about the facts and put the wrong opinions to bed that way. And thank you guys thank you, Roberto, for putting up a petition to get rid of the anti-denial laws. And thank you for coming on to help.
Absolutely. I want to get rid of this argument, you know. I don't want people, revisionists, so-called revisionists, to say we are being persecuted.
Okay.
Where
can people find more about your ideas?
About our ideas, you can find out on the blog Holocaust controversies, of which I sent you several links, including one about
Holocaust
this.
Controversies. We got 10 seconds. Holocaust controversies for Roberto Mierlenkamp and at truthjihad.blogspot.com.
We all need to prepare ourselves. You might have the food, water, gold, and silver, but ask yourself, are you truly prepared? That's why you need to visit MaineMilitary.com. MaineMilitary.com carries everything you need. Gas masks, wool blankets, fire starter kits, high-capacity magazines, chemical suits, military surplus items, and much more. Do you own a firearm? MaineMilitary.com has a large selection of pistols and rifles suited for your needs. Are your local stores sold out of ammunition? Call or visit them today for prices on hard-to-find ammo and bulk ammo orders. You don't need to worry about having a military surplus store in your area, because MaineMilitary.com is the only store you'll ever need, all from the comfort of your computer. Visit them online today at MaineMilitary.com. That's Maine, like the state, military.com. Or call them at 1-877-608-0179. That's 1-877-608-0179.
Hey there, this is Tom Ward with a question. What's in your water? Not sure? Many aren't. Still looking around heavy, expensive, and wasteful bottles just because you don't trust your tap water? Now you don't have to, thanks to Echolo Blue. The Echolo Blue 30 atmospheric water generator extracts moisture straight from the air or turns your tap water into 99.98% pure drinking perfection, continuously, efficiently, and without plastic bottles. At an average cost of just 20 cents per gallon at 8 gallons per day, you'll save lots of money over bottled water and ensure the health and safety of you and your family. Get off the grid and declare your water independence today. Go to echoloblue.com today to get the ultimate in pure, cost-effective, and bottle-free drinking water. Or call 800-691-6043. That's ECOLOBLUE.com or 800-691-6043. Echoloblue, leading the water solution revolution.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. If you are ready to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience
experience your body healing itself, then you're ready for Heart and Body Extract from Healthy Hearts Club. Heart and Body Extract has a 23-year proven track record of using certified organic herbs that make up an excellent formula to balance and support the heart and circulatory system. In as little as 2 weeks, you can feel amazing results when your 2-month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Prepare your mind to experience American Freedom Radio.
I want it!
Rents Radio with Jeff Rents. Deadline Live with Jack Blood. The Truth Brigade. Truth Jihad Radio. Liberty Cafe. Weird Radio Russell Dowden. And so much more. American Freedom Radio.